Basically going to report on a complementary result to that continues this tradition of spherically symmetric metrics. Basically what we're doing here is the equivalent of what people were doing in the 30s, trying to find solutions with sources to general relativity that could contemplate the existence of compact objects and a cosmological expansion. So since Flavio started with one shell of dust, then he moved on to two shells of dust, and then there started to be problems. Then we do the natural thing that physicists do. We move to an infinitely more complicated problem, and we try infinite shells of a perfect fluid. So let's see if we can find a solution of shape dynamics using the York description that satisfies our prerequisites of having a CMC foliation and a compact spatial manifold, and see what we can take from there. I'm a general relativist, so I'm not exactly a shape dynamicist, so I don't have any Flavio graphics on my presentation as well. And since I come from a GR background, the idea here is to convert the shape dynamics equations of motion into general relativity equations of motion that we can just solve in the CMC gauge, right? So here are the assumptions that we make. So we want a compact 3 space with a CMC foliation. We are going to ignore the causal structure for now because this is not something that shape dynamics looks at immediately. And we're trying to find black holes in the presence of self-gravitating matter. So this is not exactly a gravitational collapse problem. It's more a back reaction problem. So we're looking for a self-gravitating fluid. So a time-dependent metric that has some black hole or some compact object description. So basically, it addresses the question of, okay, so in general relativity, there's a more or less straightforward answer to when, at which scale in a bound system does cosmology begin to become important. So this in GR has a way to deal, there's a way to deal with this. So can we extend this to shape dynamics, and can we look at degrees of freedom? Can we look at what the theory has to say about these? Right, so basically we're looking at basically GR with some matter source that we will take to be a perfect fluid for now. We're not going to go into what the components of the energy momentum tensor are individually, because shape dynamics we can give names to these things, but it's not clear how they behave in the shape dynamics. So whatever we can say is that if it's a perfect fluid, we can change this into a scalar field or some K essence with some crazy kinetic term, and it will work. I mean, it will have some sound definition. It may not behave like a hydrodynamic perfect fluid, but it will behave the problem is that it has to be a well-posed. It needs to be well-posed. So as long as it's a K essence, it's still well-posed. So that's the important part.
Why are you saying that delta S over delta psi vanishes? Is this like the condition on which foliation you're using?
The second one is a co-moving condition.
Yeah.
So basically, what I want is my coordinate systems to be co-moving with my matter, right? Right. Yeah. So I still want something to behave weirdly in the center. If this is a removable singularity or not, I want it to be a singularity in GR. So my equations of motion are going to be those of GR in this gauge. So let's go through the equation. So basically, the momentum constraint and the CMC condition are going to give us these. These are the same momentum functions that Flavio has. So this is basically the same notation. I'm using y squared for the error radius instead of sigma, and I think that's the only difference. Oh, and mu for the radial component of the metric, right? The Hamiltonian constraint just gives us this equation, which is not very informative for now, but if you were paying attention to Flavio's talk, is this going back to bite us in the end? Because this is going to yield a polynomial that we have no immediate answer to. Fine. Now, the metric equations of motion, basically, they become very simple, depending on what fields you consider as sources. We will choose a gauge with no shift for simplicity. There's nothing that forces us and nothing that forbids us from doing this for now. And this basically allows us to write finally the 3 metric in this conformally static form. So basically we have some conformal factor here that multiplies some spatially maximally symmetric spatial factor. And all the time evolution of this metric is encoded in this mu function. we finally can find, by placing these back into the equations of motion, we find a solution for the lapse, also in terms of mu. And the equation of motion for the momentum is just going to give us this horrific result. Now, this part here depends on mu, which is all the all our dynamics is encoded in. But here we have this section that only depends on what I defined as the area radius of my metric. So if you so area radius is r squared r times mu, that's the full area. So this is the commoving the conformal equivalent of the area radius. So we have one gauge choice left to do. So let's choose this to be zero. When we do that, basically we reduce our function r to these three very familiar choices. So we choose a maximally symmetric gauge. Because we are interested in compact solutions, let's choose positive k. So we need something that is spatially closed. This is shaping up nicely to something that far away from our central point becomes an FRW or a closed FRW metric. But we still have no clue as to what a nice solution for mu is going to be. Because in the end, this equation becomes assumes a very simple format, and there's this unknown function of r, chi of r, that's just some integration constant. Now, exact solutions of this polynomial here, of this equation here, define the Kustanimov-Weiss class of solutions that was found in the 1947s. It started in the 30s, but in 47 it was formalized as this, as the a bunch of solutions were identified as belonging to this class here. So basically, all solutions of this equation here define metrics with a CMC foliation in a perfect fluid with a shear free motion, which basically is perfect. So these are basically interchangeable definitions. There are some physically interesting subcases. One of them obviously is FRW, if we choose that to be zero. There's the Wyman subclass in which you choose your fluid to have a barotropic equation of motion. But assuming barotropic equation of motion and all these other conditions makes it way too constrained, so it's not really any good for us. As I said, any scalar field and chaos sources that you plug in are going to give you metrics of this form. And as I said, this kind of metric has been constantly rediscovered in the literature. Up to 2 years ago, there are still papers in which people rediscover these metrics. And Roberto Sussman actually made a nice PhD thesis in which he cataloged all of these metrics. It's published in three volumes. They're gigantic. And he was so happy that I cited him because he told me, you're the first person to read this. And well, it's a very extensive work. He drew causal diagrams for all of them.
It's quite a character.
Yeah, it's very, very thorough. Right. Okay, so we still need some clue to choose some function here. So I'm going to go back to my GR background. And let's look at the Hawking-Hayward mass, which, for those of you who know your spherical symmetry, becomes the Misner-Sharp mass when you choose when you reduce your metric. So basically, it's when you do your 2+2 foliation, it's defined as this Hamiltonian on this two surface. Basically, depends on fluid projections of your metric. If it's in spherical symmetry, it becomes the Misner-Sharp mass. It's in asymptotically flat spacetime, it becomes the ADM mass. So basically, it's some generic function to encompass all these other particular cases. The nice thing about the Hawking-Hayward mass in this form is that it can be decomposed in parts that depend one on the Ricci tensor and one on the Weyl tensor. Now this is interesting because in GR, the Weyl tensor doesn't go into the equations of motion, and it's usually associated with the central sources, with compact objects, which is what we're looking for. So the Ricci part is basically going to be due to some matter distribution, and we don't really care about that. Let's see what the Weyl part tells us. Plugging this, the Weyl part of Misner-Sharp mass back and introducing the results that we got from the equations, this is what we find. Now, we have desired properties for our solution, right? We want the four-dimensional Weyl tensor to diverge at the origin, so there is something that resembles a black hole singularity. We want this thing to behave asymptotically as a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, so we need, at the antipode of our compact foliation, we need the Weyl tensor to be smooth. So let's define this ansatz here. And the motivation for this is that in the flat case, this is basically a constant and equal m for which we just decided out of psychological reasons, right? If we plug this ansatz back into that system, it solves it completely, and we get this very familiar form for our function. And the lapse fixing equation basically just gives us, just completes the system. And this is the McVitie metric, which was found in 1933 as a, one early attempt at describing a black hole in a Friedman background. Now let's see what the, once we do all this, let's solve the Hamiltonian constraint. And then we have the same problem that Flavio had. So basically this becomes a polynomial that may become singular depending on the on these quantities here. But but it's not necessarily so as long as we choose our density. So basically here we have way too many free parameters for this to be any issue at all. So basically we have a pressure, we have a density that we can play around with. And we haven't really gone into this, but this would give us the equivalent of some energy conditions, basically, right? So this metric is way too simple. It's just some fluid that behaves in a shear free motion. The Hubble expansion is basically the same everywhere. So it's not, it doesn't even answer our original question of whether cosmology, when does cosmology begin to become important? So it doesn't answer us. But it's a first step towards finding some fully dynamical solution with a back reaction and with something that resembles a singularity in the center, maybe a black hole. Now, is it a black hole? Well, we know that in GR it is. So in GR, we have these nice Penrose diagrams with apparent horizons doing some crazy stuff here. And in the end, we always end up with some geodesically incomplete regions past some null boundary here, which is the event horizon. But another interesting thing that we find is a past singularity in these metrics. Now, the past singularity is a common feature of every shear-free perfect fluid solution in GR. But this is a divergence of the four-dimensional Ricci tensor, which we don't care in shape dynamics. In shape dynamics, everything is regular here. So basically, this is what's called in the literature as the McVitie Big Bang, is just a regular surface in shape dynamics. So it can be traversed. And it can be extended past this point. And what happens back past this point, this analysis can't really cover because these coordinates become meaningless over there. But the interesting thing is, this becomes a point that can be thought of as either a reflection, so you can repeat this causal diagram or some equivalent description of this causal diagram flipped upside down in these lower regions, so it would be a Janus point. Or it can be just some surface beyond which evolution continues normally and we don't. We need to use different coordinates to actually treat it. So basically, this is another sandbox for us to do consistency analyses of shape dynamics. So it's not just so it has the advantage of not of us not having to deal with junction conditions and Israel conditions, but it does introduce other difficulties such as what kinds of fluids are reasonable choices? What kinds of dynamics do we expect? Defining whether these surfaces are reachable or not, if they're incomplete or not, then we have to change coordinates. Changing coordinates has the danger of abandoning the CMC foliation, and then we are still in uncertain territory there. But basically, this is one new metric, one new result to the collection of shape dynamics solutions. Thank you.
Okay. We don't have time for questions. We're already running super late. I'm going to blame Flavio for that.
Sorry.
He ran over time. So Eric, the last talk of the day. Eric Curiel is going to speak about a bio-type theorem in geometrized Newtonian gravity and how it may bear on shape dynamics.
Thank you. So
let me just give you this. I'm going to need...
I have a few things I want to say just very quickly before I begin the talk proper. Actually, I had to write them down. One is I also have no graphics from Flavio. I actually have no graphics at all, so sorry about that. Just a lot of equations and text, going to be boring. I'm an interloper. I'm a philosopher, primarily. And I'm not, as y'all probably noticed my questions, I'm not an expert in shape dynamics at all. Almost everything I know about shape dynamics I've learned from conversations with Sean. So also, Sean was the one who urged me to give this talk in particular. So if you don't like it, blame Sean. Since I mentioned my questions, I think it's incredibly rude for people to interrupt during a talk with questions. So please don't. No, I'm a hypocrite, but I'm not that big of a hypocrite. And please feel free to interrupt me. Of course I am. I'm enough of a hypocrite that other people's hypocrisy bothers me. Okay. Unfortunately, I can't stay for the whole conference. I have to leave tomorrow evening. So I just want to apologize in advance for the people speaking on. I'm going to miss the Friday talks. I apologize for that. And as we know, this is the last talk. I was going to say you're going to need some wine after this talk anyway, but since we're running so late, you're really going to need some wine after this talk. So I'm going to be speaking on a vial type theorem in classical spacetimes and how it may bear in shape dynamics. The last part is very speculative since I don't know much about shape dynamics, so I'm just really kind of, you'll tell me if you think it's relevant or not. So you may wonder why I'm interested in classical spacetimes in the first place. As you'll see, it's primarily in the framework of what is often called geometrized Newtonian gravitation. It's also often called Newton-Cartan theory because Cartan developed it back, I think, in the 20s, if I remember correctly, in an attempt to see how similar one could make Newtonian gravitational theory to general relativity. It turns out one can make it extremely similar in many ways. And then Trautmann did some really amazing work in the 60s showing exactly the relationship between the geometrized version ordinary Newtonian gravity in a way that really also makes clear the relationship to general relativity. So why am I interested in that in the context of shape dynamics? Well, because a lot of shape dynamics, so far as I can tell right now, at least some of it, is being done in the context of Newtonian gravity. And I think that this geometrized formulation perhaps might be able to be used to give a more geometrical formulation, intrinsically geometrical formulation, of a lot of the very elegant and beautiful results that Julian and others have talked about today. We'll see. So I'll start by describing Weyl's theorem in general relativity, because the goal is to give what I think is the closest analog one can give of Weyl's theorem in Newtonian gravitational theory. And I hope by the end you'll see why that's relevant. So Weyl proved in 1918, given a conformal structure on a differential manifold and a projective structure agreeing with it on images of its null geodesics, there is a Lorentz metric fixed up to a constant factor, a global constant, having each as its associated structure of that kind. So more informally, if I know the projective structure and I know the conformal structure, I know the metric up to a constant. Extraordinary theorem. It is very powerful interpretive tool. Oh, by the way, I'm really going to blast through this since we're running so late. So, and I'll probably skip over some things. But if you see something I'm skipping over and you want to stop me, you know, please do. Basically, it allows you to give probably my favorite way to operationalize the full geometry of general relativity. If I know the paths of light rays in vacuo and I know the images, not preferred parameterization, just the images of the paths of freely falling particles, I know the metric. That's an extraordinarily simple, physically I think very compelling and intuitive way to give empirical content to the purity of Lorentzian geometry on four manifolds, the completely abstract purity of Lorentzian geometry on four manifolds. So I'm going to see how much I can reconstruct of a theorem similar to this in the context of classical space times. What do I mean by classical space time? Well, I'll give you a definition because I'm a philosopher. A classical space-time model is an ordered quadruplet, MHT nabla, such that M is a four-dimensional, paracompact, connected, smooth differential manifold. See, intuitively, the collection of all events in our space-time. HAB, it's important. Yes. It's important that the indices are up, and I'll explain why. It's a smooth symmetric tensor field of signature 0, 1, 1, 1. Signature is being used here in a slightly non-standard way. I mean that in the tangent plane of every point, one can always choose three linearly independent vectors such that, I'm sorry, three linearly, in the cotangent plane of every point, I'm trying to go too fast. In the cotangent plane of every point, one can choose three linearly independent one forms such that their joint contraction with HAB is one and they are mutually orthogonal in the sense that contracting two of them in pairs with HAB gives zero. We're in a four-dimensional.
So you mean you choose four vectors.
I'm sorry. So I can choose four linearly independent one forms, such that if you like the norm of one is zero, the norm of the other three are one, and the three that have one they're all mutually orthogonal, so to speak. So TAB is a smooth symmetric tensor field of M of signature 1, 0, 0. That basically means the same thing here, except now we just have one that's non-zero. T and H are orthogonal, and Nabla, it's a derivative operator compatible with T and H in the standard sense. H is going to be our spatial metric in a Pickwickian sense. T is going to be the temporal metric in a slightly more straightforward sense. Nabla is the affine structure in our spacetime. And just for simplicity, I'm going to assume that M is simply connected and temporally orientable. And in this context, that means that I can always decompose TAB in this way. And all of these assumptions are not at all crucial to the results. It just means I don't have to keep track of local versus global and all that kind of crap that really isn't physically to me very illuminating, and just pushes some technical issues aside. So some definitions now, more definitions. C is time. So a tangent vector is time-like if its contraction with the temporal metric is not zero, it's space-like otherwise. It's kind of natural to think of zero as both time-like and space-like. HAB, as I remarked before, defines the spatial metric structure in a more indirect way, and this proposition captures that sense. So a vector is space-like if and only if there's a covector such that Z is the result of raising the index, so to speak, of the covector with H. And in fact, if raising their indices is equal, then they have the same norm. And we call one of these guys a representative space-like one-form in this case. So the global structure here's the way to think about why this is a classical space-time. The surfaces of constant T are the simultaneous slices. They're absolute space in a moment of time in the Newtonian picture. A vector is space-like if and only if it's tangent to a simultaneity slice. That's easy to see. There's a determinate, unambiguous temporal interval between any two events. There's absolute time in the Newtonian picture. And spatial distance is defined only between simultaneous events. And that's exactly why we use the upstairs indices on H. Because if there's no canonical H with downstairs indices such that that I can invert up the upstairs H, not even when restricted to simultaneity slices. And that's if there were such a thing, then if I knew how to assign a spatial length to time-like vectors, which is exactly what I'm ruling out, and so affix a spatial separation between non-simultaneous events, I'd be able to define a notion of absolute rest. A body would be absolute rest if its world line had zero spatial length all along. So HAB really is exactly the right thing we want to capture the spatial metrical structure of Newtonian physics. So I'm actually not going to use this in what follows. So I was thinking of skipping over it, but I think I just want to very quickly. Sketch the relationship of this to gravity, since that is one of the themes of shape dynamics. Just to show how this classical geometrical spacetime structure allows one, in fact, to formulate a theory of the theory of Newtonian gravity in a geometrized sense. So a geometrized Newtonian gravity space-time model is an ordered pair. But C is a classical space-time model. Rho is a smooth non-negative scalar function on M. Obviously, it's supposed to represent mass density. And the following conditions on the curvature hold. So the Ricci tensor is rho TATB. As we'll see in a moment, this is really kind of the Poisson equation in disguise. And also, interestingly enough, this geometrical formalism, by the way, one of its most beautiful aspects, it gives one a very precise context within which one can talk about the limit of Newtonian gravitational theory as the limit of general relativity as one flattens the null cones, and one recovers Newtonian gravitational theory. One recovers exactly this space-time structure, and the Einstein field equation, in fact, turns into this. It's a very beautiful construction. One also, in fact, as it ends up, at least, I mean, one doesn't have to require these two conditions, but if one wants something that really looks and smells like Newtonian gravity, one really does. For those who are immersed in general relativity, this may seem like an odd condition, because how could this fail? But of course, the only way we know how to raise indices in our current situation is with HAB. And so in fact, this is a highly non-trivial condition. We don't have a metric where we can just raise and lower indices, you know, willy-nilly. We have only this kind of a degenerate Pickwickian spatial metric to raise indices. So this is actually a non-trivial condition. And we'll actually see at the end of the talk what the geometrical interpretation, or one way to understand the geometrical meaning of this in this context is. And again, this also is a non-trivial geometrical condition. I'm not going to talk about it, and it won't play any role in what happens. It does follow those from these conditions, interestingly enough, that geometrized Newtonian gravity, space is always flat. This kind of sounds intuitively right in Newtonian gravity, right? There's all the curvature is in the time-like direction. You know, because stuff is, you know, that stuff affected by gravity is moving along these curved paths.
Mm-hmm. Just one quick question.
Please.
What sort of picture should I have for matter, particles or matter density?
One can do either. In fact. One can take rho as a continuous density and think of it as a fluid. One can think of it as representing, you know, dust particles. It works either way. So, and in fact, I mentioned earlier the construction in which one flattens the null cones in general relativity and gets Newtonian gravity. One can actually see in this process how, in fact, if you like, curvature is kind of squashed out of the spatial slices. It's really quite remarkable. So I'll very quickly, you may be thinking, well, this is, this all looks kind of cool, but what does it really have to do with Newtonian gravity? Well, two theorems that Trautmann proved in the 60s makes it abundantly clear. The first is often called the geometrization lemma. So if you fix one of these Newtonian gravity space-time models such that the derivative operator is flat and a smooth scalar field such that it really satisfies what's really, you know, kind of looks like the Poisson equation, where remember, whenever I raise indices, I'm raising them with HAB. So this really is the spatial Poisson equation. If I define another derivative operator by a difference tensor that is of this form, then it follows that this is also a geometrized Newtonian gravitational space-time model. So it, in particular, it satisfies, you know, these curvature conditions. And it's the unique derivative operator such that the vector field C is geodesic with respect to the new derivative operator if and only if, with respect to the old flat one, the curvature of the Xi paths are given as the gradient of the gravitational force. So this really tells you, you give me an ordinary flat, you know, Newtonian gravitational theory where gravity is really represented by a scalar potential and the force is the gradient. I can completely geometrize all that away and just represent the action of gravity by a curved affine structure and where really there's no gravity anymore. Just everything's in inertial motion. It's just in curved inertial motion. Gravity has become incorporated into the curved geometry of space-time, very much like general relativity.
So your original operator is
compatible with the metric and torsion-free.
That's right. Okay. They all are. And one can go the other way. One can start with one of these completely geometrized models. And one can always find a derivative operator, a flat derivative operator in a scalar field that, if you like, that de-geometrizes it, returns you back to, you know, a flat affine structure, such that again, the old geodesics correspond now to curves that are whose acceleration is given by the gradient of the scalar field. And what's quite interesting, and this captures, if one likes, the gauge freedom in Newtonian gravitational theory. One can always add arbitrary accelerations, you know, over time, and that's exactly what's happening here. One in fact can always find a whole bunch of other flat derivative operators and scalar fields that will satisfy the same conditions, that will give you the same physics, if and only if these two conditions are satisfied, which are really just the acceleration gauge freedom in Newtonian gravity. So in what follows, I'm going to ignore the gravitational part. I'm going to restrict myself just to the kinematical geometry of the classical space-time model. So that's, recall, the manifold, TAB, HAB, and the affine structure. I'm only going to require this curvature condition, and again, as I say, that will become clear what that means by the end of the talk. And in particular, I'm not requiring that this model be spatially flat. That is, if I did, it would be kind of boring and probably of no relevance at all to shape dynamics. And well, just kind of boring generally anyway. So in order to formulate something like a Weyl type theorem on these structures, I have to tell you what I mean by conformal structure. And in this context, it's just not clear at all what one might mean by that, because there are no non-trivial null cones. So what do I mean by conformal structure in when I have this kind of space-time structure? I'm going to take my inspiration. In fact, I came up with this idea a while ago before I ever even talked to Sean about shape dynamics, and it turns out to be quite similar, I think quite similar in spirit. Recall, you know, two Lorentz metrics are conformally equivalent if and only if they agree on orthogonality relations among all vectors. They agree on all angle relations. And so I'm going to use this to define the analog of a spatial conformal structure, what I think is the appropriate analog of a spatial conformal structure in this context. So we begin by saying two space-like vectors are orthogonal if their representatives are orthogonal, and it's easy to check this is independent of representative. And again, this makes physical sense. In Newtonian physics, I know how to determine whether two forces at a given moment act at right angles to each other. So the idea that I can define orthogonality for spatial vectors, I think, is physically well motivated. In this context. And I'll say that two spatial metrics are conformally equivalent if they agree on orthogonality relations, and it's then just completely trivial that they're conformally equivalent if and only if they in fact are look like they're conformally equivalent in the standard sense we're all used to. So then I define a spatial conformal structure consists of a distribution of three-dimensional vector subspaces of the cotangent bundle at every point, well, over the manifold, and orthogonality relations fixed for all pairs of one-forms, such that the distribution of the three-dimensional subspaces of tangent vectors determined by the associated family of HAB is integrable. So I'm defining privileged three spaces in the cotangent plane of every point of the manifold. I'm demanding they be integrable in the sense that they form, you know, complete three-dimensional submanifolds. These are the simultaneity slices. And I'm only requiring that I know the orthogonality relations of all these one-forms from which I get the orthogonality relations among the vectors from the classes of the upstairs spatial metrics that are conformally related to each other. Then one can define a spatial conformal derivative operator. It's just the family of derivative operators, each of which is compatible with some spatial metric in the conformal family, and just call a representative in one of these pairs. And it's interesting, it's not hard to show, and not hard to see, I think, physically, that being spatially twist-free is a conformal invariant. It doesn't matter which representative you pick. This is a well-defined relation, and that will play a role later on. So temporal conformal structure is quite similar, and again, I'm not going to say it as explicitly. If I know how, the time-like vectors in one of these in a Newtonian manifold form a convex open four-dimensional subset of the tangent plane at every point. So there's no orthogonality relation. I can't say two time-like vectors are orthogonal to each other, so I can't define ordinary angle relations. But actually, very very similarly to what one does say in Minkowski spacetime, I can define the hyperbolic angles between them in the completely standard way. I can say that two temporal metrics agree when they agree on hyperbolic angle relations. And again, it's completely trivial that when that happens, that you can show that the temporal metric, that the two are conformally related if and only if there's a strictly positive scalar field that makes one a multiple of the other. And one, again, defines one now defines, instead of a distribution of three-dimensional cotangent planes, one rather defines a distribution of three-dimensional vector subspaces such that this representative one form is, that the representative one form defines is integrable, and one says that the two conformal, and again, one defines a temporal conformal derivative in the same way. It's an ordered pair such that they're compatible with each other. And then a full Newtonian conformal structure is spatial and temporal one that are compatible in the sense that they define the same simultaneity slices, essentially. And it follows, in fact, that if all I give you is a spatial conformal structure, that uniquely picks out a temporal conformal structure, and vice versa, in fact. It's not as trivial as that may sound, because one has to show that the derivative operators and the families are the same, but it turns out they are. And again, one can just define then the conformal derivative operators, the family of all derivative operators, each of which is compatible with one of these conformal structures. And okay, so you may be thinking, oh, great, Kirill, why do I care? Well, it's because if this is going to be a physically meaningful analog of conformal structure and general relativity at all, it should allow me to define a notion of space-like geodesic, just like the conformal structure picks out univocally the null geodesics. And if all I know are the null cones, in fact, I know the null geodesics, which is, again, quite a remarkable fact in general relativity. And I claim, if I know the conformal structure, which remember is fixed by the spatial conformal structure, I claim I know the spatial geodesics up to, I know them projectively at least. And so the exact statement is, Z and eta be two space-like vector fields everywhere orthogonal to each other. That's well defined. That's just given by the conformal structure. And with a vanishing Lie bracket, I don't need anything but the manifold differential structure to define that. Then the integral curves are projective geodesics of the conformal derivative operator, i.e. for any representative, this relation holds for some non-negative lambda. And every projective geodesic of the conformal derivative operator is part of such a family. So this allows me finally, I'm going very quickly, so I apologize. A lot of this deserves more elaboration, because I think some of it's very pretty. But that's life in the big conference city, right? So we say that a projective structure and a Newtonian conformal structure are compatible with each other if the conformal space-like geodesics determined by the Newtonian conformal structure are also projective geodesics. I mean projective structure on the whole four-dimensional manifold now. Then we finally are getting to the meat, because this has all been set up. It's a lot of setup, right? I mean, it's kind of a schizophrenic talk, because I'm trying to the geometrized classical space-time structure and the geometrized Newtonian gravitational theory, I think, are not very well known, especially among physicists. Philosophers tend to talk about them more. But it's a very beautiful way of thinking about classical space-time structure and of Newtonian gravitational theory. So I think it is of some intrinsic interest to try and figure this out. I'm sorry.
There is a nice treatment of this.
Yes, there is.
In
yes, there.
Nine.
Yes, there is. It's very beautiful. Well, yeah. it's abbreviated, but it's very nice. Yeah. Yes. So start with a lemma. If I have a spatial conformal structure and a compatible objective structure, that actually suffices to fix the temporal and spatial metrics up to spatially constant factors, and the derivative operator up to a difference tensor of this form, where lambda is spatially constant. So that's not quite the Weyl, that's not quite the Weyl type theorem I want to get to, but it's kind of halfway there. So what this basically tells me is that knowing the conformal structure and the projective structure, knowing orthogonality relations for space-like vectors, and knowing the paths of the unparameterized paths of massive bodies, free-falling massive bodies, allows me to fix temporal and spatial metrics up to spatially constant conformal factors. And almost immediate corollary to this, that this lemma allows one almost immediately to show, in fact, that you actually don't just get that you actually get a proper affine parameterization for the space-like geodesics. They determine so these two jointly actually determine an affine structure, a three-dimensional affine structure on each of the simultaneity slices. The affine structures are not in any way systematically related to each other. Of course, the full thing has to be smooth, but it doesn't allow you to say, for instance, it doesn't allow you to define parallel propagation of space-like curves that, that leave simultaneity slices, so to speak. So this finally gets us to what I think is the closest analog to a Weyl type theorem in Newtonian gravity. Given a spatial conformal structure and a projective structure, and a spatially twist-free time-like vector field of constant length on each simultaneity slice, that's well-defined because I've claimed that these two fix the spatial and temporal metrics up to constants on each slice, then in fact there exists a unique conformal representative such that Z is unit with respect to the temporal metric and geodesic with respect to nabla, and now here's where the curvature condition enters, if and only if this curvature condition holds. I think one can use this to give a physical interpretation now of the geometrical structure that is the kinematics for Newtonian gravitational theory in a similar way to how Weyl's theorem allows one to operationalize the metric in GR. So to know what forces are orthogonal to each other and to know the images of the paths of freely falling bodies fixes the spatial derivative operator. It fixes the total derivative operator up to factors of the time-like metric, and it fixes the spatial and temporal metrics up to spatially constant factors. Then, to fix one non-rotating family of standard clocks, all traveling at the same speed, is to fix the entire geometry of the classical space-time. Now, the reason why I think that this kind of smells kind of shape dynamics-y is because I think it's really nice that one does not get the temporal structure until one, in effect, fixes a standard of rest everywhere. It's, first of all, to me, quite remarkable that one has to fix only one time-like vector field to get the full affine structure. Normally, one has to fix a whole shitload of curves to get a full affine structure. But here, you really are just fixing one time-like congruence. And as y'all know better than I do, in shape dynamics, you don't want the three geometries to have a fixed kind of canonical time parameterization for their parameterized evolution. So this is the reason why I think this theorem, insofar as it's interesting at all beyond the scope of Newtonian gravitational theory, may be of interest to people who work in shape dynamics. And I will conclude with one slide which gives my suggestions for why it may be of interest, and this is where you guys will probably think I'm completely stupid, but we'll see. It seems to me like it might actually be of interest, given what I claim is the natural interpretation of the theorem, to reformulate Newtonian shape dynamics in the geometrized picture, where one can give a geometrically intuitive notion of what spatial conformal geometry is, and where it just automatically falls out that one does not get a privileged temporal parameterization of the entire space-time structure. And secondly, and this is much more speculative and vague, and I'm not really even sure how to make it precise. I'm really just throwing an incredibly inchoate idea out. You know, I'm casting my bread onto the waters and seeing if it may come back to me in time, as Ecclesiastes suggests it will. Although it'll probably be really soggy and chewed on if it does. But given the special status accorded to embedded three manifolds and the reconstruction of general relativity, maybe instead of using the Riemannian three metric and a scalar field that encodes the lapse, it might be of interest to see whether, in fact, one can use a geometrical structure like this one. Because the only thing one might worry about is, well, it looks awful hard to reconstruct the null cones from this. But as I just heard in response to my question in the previous talk, who cares? So that was paraphrased, by the way. So if you in fact do this, I mean, it seems to me there's a quite natural way of thinking about how this upstairs spatial metric encodes the shift and the downstairs temporal metric encodes the lapse, and one automatically gets non-privileged temporal and spatial scales by doing that. Again, I have no idea if one can actually make that work. Just throwing ideas out there. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for -2 questions.
All right. I'm very happy to take questions over wine if people just want to go. But yeah, hey, if you have questions.
Question, okay, my question is not is what? To ask questions. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the other question? So are you saying with one that, number one, that maybe, one problem that mm-hmm. We have with Newtonian mm-hmm. dynamics is that we would also like to do something that is very standard, and mm-hmm. is to study fluid dynamics or continuum mm-hmm. dynamics. Mm-hmm. But Newtonian shape dynamics is just about mm-hmm. point particles and mm-hmm. studying the shape space of a finite number of particles by pushing to embedded scale. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea how to mm-hmm. study a continuum, a fluid. And this mm-hmm. is maybe the
well,
way,
so I now understand, Julian, why you asked that question. I think, as far as I can tell, on my incredibly naive understanding of this, this should be a way to do it because I can. There's rho can easily be a continuum, and I've told you how to make sense of the conformal three-dimensional spatial structure. So, hey man, that'd be incredibly cool.
I think it's really. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know what the configuration space of mm-hmm. Continuum dust is in the Newtonian dynamics. Mm-hmm. It's a field theory, but mm-hmm. I know what the shape space of a discrete number, mm-hmm. Finite number of particles is. But mm-hmm. So far, I have no idea what the shape mm-hmm. space of a continuum mm-hmm. dust is. So it's... The other question is, you said that all of these Newtonian geometric structures mm-hmm. Can be tied very tightly. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. To the C tends to infinity limit.
Yes.
Over
it's in fact it's a way to make that precise because C goes to infinity. Strictly speaking, makes no sense because you're dealing with different state spaces of solution. So C goes to infinity doesn't even make any sense. This picture actually tells you geometrically how to do it precisely, rigorously, in a way that really makes intuitively clear what's going on. I'm sorry.
Right. Now the question is just presumably this theorem or sketch of theorem that you. That is the leftover of mm-hmm. the Weyl theorem.
That's, I think that's right.
Then what is the precursor of this Xi vector field in the GR case?
I mean, the GR case is, the Weyl theorem in GR case is so beautiful because you don't need the Xi. You get everything just from conformal and projective structure. So I don't really understand this yet myself. I really want to understand it, why it is that in Newtonian gravity, it forces this temporal freedom on you. You can I can know everything I know in relativity theory, but I still have extraordinary gauge freedom in choosing my temporal metric. That I don't know why that happens. I understand geometrically why it happens. Physically, I don't really understand it. And I also, and again, geometrically, I understand why to fix one non-rotating time-like vector field gives me everything. And I mean, physically, that one makes a little more sense. I'm basically fixing a standard of rest.
Right.
But it's odd that is it odd that a standard of rest? Yeah.
Okay,
let's go get some wine. Yes, okay, great.